This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Resistance group here that's involved in all of the housing justice work. Have y'all heard about that? People being kicked out of their houses here and people moving them back in, resisting police. That's what we do. My young brother comrade here, Itzley, is actually facing some charges. Y'all need to support him. For us helping people stay in their houses, so we do that. I also work for SEIU, the union, and do a lot of organizing work for them. So I know some of you from that as well. So greetings. Those are all sides of me. So what is a settler colony? What's a settler colony?
Occupied land.
Occupied land. What else? That's true. What else is it? A nation of sovereignty? Invasion of sovereignty. Okay. Yes. Anybody else?
Probably exploitation, natural resources.
Right. Right. And of course, you all know, as you're saying all those wonderful things, that we're sitting on one of the settler colonies right here, a land that was stolen from the indigenous people and is maintained, built on the backs of those people. So the basis of what we're going to talk about here today is that a lot of the economy of this society was built on the triangular slave trade. Y'all, you know that, right? So because that happened, it supplied a tremendous amount of free labor to build up the economic wealth of this society, and the society of the industrialized capitalist world came from the exploitation brought on by the triangular slave trade. The problem that's happened is now we fast forward to 2013, and the cotton has been picked. There are machines to do it now. They don't need people to do it. So the question is, what happens to all those millions of people who essentially are here to pick cotton? You don't need them to do that anymore. There was never any real sincere effort to integrate them into this society. So the question is what to do with them. And that's the basis of, I'm putting that out there like that because that's the basis of where we're coming from today. My analysis is that anybody that's African in this society, we're not Americans. And we can't ever really be Americans. It was never about us being Americans. In fact, I would even say the only reason why I'm standing here, the only reason why my brother is here, the only reason why my brother and my sister are here, whether we know it or not, whether we want to admit it or not, whether we talk about it or not, the only reason we're here is because your great-grandmother ran left instead of right. That's it. That's the only reason we're sitting here right now. That's irrefutable. What that means is that she ran left, so the British got her, and we're sitting here today, period. If she ran right, we'd probably be in Sierra Leone. Or maybe the Spanish would have got her, we'd be in Cuba, who knows. But that's, bottom line, that's what it comes down to. So the last 500 years really is all about that, that the cotton is picked, and we're here now. And we present a major problem to this society. And I would go farther to say, I don't even know why we would want to be Americans. I don't know why anybody would want to be an American. I don't understand why. I don't even know this thing of an American identity because to me, you can't really separate American identity from white supremacy. I don't see how you, so when you say you're American, you might have the best intentions. You're basically saying, I'm a part of this white supremacist plan, and I'm down with that. I'm going to stick with that. Whatever color you are, when you say that, that's what you're saying, because America is all about white supremacy, all about that. It can't be about anything else. That's why they still have you celebrate the holidays 500 years later, because they're constantly reintroducing white supremacy to you. All these schools are named after white supremacists, right? All the money has white supremacists on it, right? All the streets and statues, white supremacists. Is that true or not? Yeah. So you can't say America is not about white supremacy, and it's just because you don't want it to be. The world isn't what we want it to be, it's what it is. So that's the premise from which we function from. And this whole question of imprisonment is really just a question of how to maintain a declining capitalist economy today, and how to do, and who is going to do that. What people are going to supply that cheap labor to the prison industry, And the most disposable people, quote-unquote, are the ones who are going to do that. And that's why we have the situation we have today. So, you know, we can talk about from, like, Nat Turner's rebellion in 1831 in Virginia. Y'all know about that, right? Nat Turner's rebellion. Okay, well, I'm going to say some things some of you might know, because I know some of us don't know, and I know I'm trying to, we're trying to lift everybody up with the same information. So, and then some of us won't know, and we won't say anything because we don't want to seem uncool. But that's, you let all that go in here today. We're not here to do that. So, Nat Turner was a brother. He was actually a Christian minister in Virginia, and he organized a rebellion in 1831 that ended up killing about 55 white plantation slaveholder people before he was captured and murdered. So 1831 to Assata Shakur in 2013. And so the question is, you know, what are the commonalities through all that time? Well, I'm arguing that, again, like I said, this society was a settler colony then when it was established, and it's still one today, meaning that you still have the people whose land it was stolen from them, the people who took it are still in power today. They still dominate based on those same principles of white supremacy, capitalism, and exploitation. So as a result of that, there's really no place for African, indigenous people, poor white people, and all working people. Really don't, you don't really have a place in this society. There isn't really a plan for you. There's nobody in power sitting around saying, well, we want to create this so that we can provide opportunities for those folks. That's not happening. So instead, what's happening is the state creates a role, sees it a part of its role to repress these communities that represent the biggest threat to its interests. What do I mean by that? Well, if you look around today, if you go to any inner city community, for example, and I go to a lot of them, you'll see, if you go to any African community, like you go to South LA or you go to West Oakland or you go to Philadelphia or Chicago, wherever you go, you'll see a lot of people. You won't see a lot of visible political organization. Not saying those things aren't happening, because they are, but you won't see a lot of visible political organization taking place. But the slightest thing can happen and the whole community could rise up and revolt. Why is that? How is that? Like the late Kwame Ture used to say all the time, like, we're the only people that will stand up and rebel and burn a city down and then sit down for 30 years. How does that happen? Because people are, they're disorganized, they're oppressed, they're suffering in these communities, but they're also disaffected from the dominant society too. They don't see themselves as a part of that. They don't see themselves as American. If you drove through ghettos after 9/11, we didn't have all them flags flying in our neighborhoods. We didn't do that. We don't see ourselves that way. We don't see ourselves, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, it's true. We don't see ourselves as a part of this society in that sense. So because of that, we constantly remain a threat to the power structure, and they know that. So that's the whole reason why they created affirmative action, all those things, but that's another story. But so the state sees its role to repress those communities. So the question is it a new role for the state to do that? Is it something that's just happened, or have they always done that? And what were the original ways that the state suppressed these communities? Well, you know, there are a lot of examples, and I know you all know some of these, but like, you all know about the Second Amendment and the contradictions with that. We don't have to get into that. The Second Amendment was about protecting the slave patrols, and that's what that was about. There are other things like the Dred Scott case in 1857, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. And, you know, the significance of those cases were primarily that what came out of that is that African people don't have rights that need to be respected by the state at all. You know, and we're basically property. So the predominance of white supremacy, and what all this means, the reason why I'm putting this up there, I want us to think about the criminalization of our existence as a people, creating that climate where we're criminalized as a people. And what that means to me is, like, the minute you see us, we're criminals in your eyes. Now, I know all of you here are conscious people and positive people, and you don't think like that. But if you think about it, your families do. I don't even know your families, and I know they do. Some of you this morning was on the phone with your mother, and she was saying something that was just totally out the back door. You know, so this is very, this is a very successful campaign that they've waged over the last several hundred years to convince millions of people that these people are criminals in this society. So consequently, whatever happens to them, that's what, yeah, because they're criminals. You see it, some of your family say this, like, I hear this, and this is even some people that call themselves conscious were saying this to me the other day. Well, how come people get upset when the police shoot somebody black, but there's black on black crime every day? Who's heard that? There's black on black crime every day. Like, what? And I said, well, what the hell, what's your point? You know, I mean, first, I don't need you to tell me that because I was in a gang, so I know all about black on black crime. And then I also have spent the last several decades fighting in my community. So I don't need you to tell me there's black on black crime. You know, but the question is, our existence as a people is devalued, whether it's by people that look like us or people that are repressing us. It's everybody sees us the same way. So I understand it. So I told the person, you're making my point for me. Because I know I've been in nightclubs before where you step on another brother's shoes and it's like a life or death situation because your life is just not worth that much. And that's the consciousness that's been imbued with us. So this creates an environment.
Can you explain about the Second Amendment?
Oh, sure. Thank you for asking that. Because you know how we are. Like, everybody likes, oh, I know all that. Why am I even sitting in this room? And people don't know, and that's good. So the Second Amendment, if you look at it, because I had listed it up there for a reason. If you look at it, the key part of it, everybody focuses on this part, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But the key part of this amendment is up here, the necessary to the security of a free state. And the significance of that is that why this is a national document, right? The Constitution. Why doesn't it say free country? Why doesn't it say free country? Why does it say free state? And the reason why it says free state, originally, in the original draft, it did say free country. Okay, but then you have people like Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson who argued that it can't say country because they wanted to make sure that the southern states had the right to protect the slave patrols who were going out and capturing Africans who escaped the plantation, or even those that had been granted their freedom and terroristically forcing them to return to the South to sharecrop. They wanted to make sure those terrorists who eventually emerged into Ku Klux Klan and eventually became police departments, they wanted to make sure those terrorists, the same terrorists that are here today, had the right to bear arms. So that's why it said states. And this is where the whole concept of states' rights came from. So this is why, like, when politicians today, they're talking like, you know, even my parents and grandparents who were not politically conscious people, you know, in the sense of how you might see it. But when politicians on TV talk about, well, we need states' rights, they knew exactly, they know that's cold against us. They knew that. My grandma's, yeah, they're trying to do something to black people every time she heard that on TV. So we know that whenever states' rights, you know, we know what that means. You're trying to say what you're going to do to us. So that's what that's about. So let's look at, those are some of the original ways in which the state created this culture of criminalization and repression. And so some of the current ways that still happen today to tie it together between what happened hundreds of years ago and what happened today is that, it's, again, continuing to criminalize our existence, like through the ICE raids and stop and frisk policies, right? So you have like hundreds of thousands of people deported last year. How do you deport hundreds of thousands of people? Does anybody, have you paid attention to how this happens? The overwhelming majority of those cases are not people who were committing crimes and then they were caught committing crimes and they were deported. That's not how that happens. What happens is that somebody, in a lot of these cases, it's situations like this. Somebody's applying for an apartment. So they submit a, you know, application and they fill it out. There's a little discrepancy with the Social Security number, right? So then the people call the police because they're like, these people are illegal. They shouldn't be here. Somebody's trying to get an apartment so they can have a place to live, go to work, have a family. Police come, person gets deported. Husband gets deported, wife gets deported. Family is left here without, in a lot of instances, their primary person making income or even just someone, anyone in their family that's vital to their family. That's how most of these deportations take place. The only way that can happen is because These folks are just criminalized, and it's like, yeah, get rid of them any way you can. They shouldn't be here, and that's just how that goes. So, yeah.
With those cases, a lot of those children end up in foster care, right?
Right.
Due to being born in the States, but their parents aren't.
This is true. This is true. Yes.
I've also heard that, I just heard about, like in slaughterhouse, like, only a handful of major slaughterhouses for the whole country, and like they often hire a lot of like undocumented immigrants. And sometimes what they'll do is just they'll call ICE on a few other employees just to keep the others on their toes, so that's how rates, so we have a high turnover rate of this cheap labor that they can just dispose of at will.
Right, and that's a real common practice. Anyone heard about that happening?
Yeah.
Does anybody understand what Jonathan just said? So like, I own a factory, I'm employing undocumented workers, and I wanna make sure, maybe the workers, somebody's saying, well, we need to make a little more money, for example. So I'm like, no, hell with that, I ain't paying them no more money, I'm gonna call ICE. So ICE comes and ships a couple away. Now I've terrorized them, so then nobody's gonna speak up and say anything. So then that's my way of controlling my work population. That's a common practice. So all of this, I think, is tied into this thing of criminalizing people, because that's the only way, because I know there's no way that can work without that happening, because what you've done is you've created an environment where people can be treated like this and nobody does anything. Because and the only reason why people don't do anything is because they think that's what's supposed to happen. That's what these people deserve. So that's a part of a process that really we all participate in. That's what I'm talking about, because I know a lot of you think, oh, I know this already. But if you're not actively involved in working against it, then you're part of this process. You're part of this mentality. Something we need to be aware of, because we all participate in it. So that comes to, like, a lot of people ask questions like with Sister Assata Shakur, why did the FBI up the bounty on her? Why are they posting these billboards? That's a part of this same process of criminalization, because they want to convince particularly everybody, but particularly young African youth, they want to convince, if you get involved in this struggle, this is what will happen to you. You'll be a criminal, you're a terrorist, you're outcast, and we will come and get you. And then also to hopefully encourage someone to be stupid enough to think they can go to Cuba and do something to her. So that's all a part of it. And another part of it is privatizing all the public resources, eliminating any resource for the poor, under the context that if you need any kind of help, then you're a burden to society, and we don't need to deal with you. They're doing that here with this university right here. There's a strong effort to privatize. Y'all know about that? I know Sonia, I know you know, but there, and I know Sam in the back, there's students at here and at U of O that I work with, and we talk about this a lot. They're trying to institute these institutional governing boards that they're going to privatize these universities. And that's what that's all a part of this whole thing. And they're talking about, how many of you in here are students? Raise your hand if you're students. Okay, how many of you guys, what do you got, what are your majors?
Physics.
Okay.
Digital learning.
Okay. So based on what they're trying to do, you're the only one that they think is worth saving. They're like, if you're not studying hard science, but see, that's what they want you to do, though. That's what they want you to do. Because that's what they're saying, is that you're the one we want, and you need to tell this person you came here with that he's a waste of time. We need to spend any more money on him. Get him out of here. That's what they're trying to do. And so it's all a part of, again, criminalizing, devaluing, dismissing people, public education, public services, attacks against the post office. How do you think that ties into what we're talking about? The post
Before
office.
Before we go there. Can I just go back to Assata? I don't want to assume that everybody in here knows who Assata Shakur is. So I'd like to ask if people do know who she is.
I don't.
I don't either.
Yeah. So I think you should elaborate on that.
Okay. All right. I will say this. You should know who Assata Shakur is, especially if you're students. So I'm not here to tell you everything. Okay? You should know who Assata Shakur is. So as a matter of fact, I'm not going to sit here and tell you who Assata Shakur is. I'm going to say you guys are students. You should investigate it. I'll just say that she is a symbol of African liberation, revolution, and forward progress. And you need to find out who she is. She's got an autobiography out here. There's plenty of information out here about her. because we need to be. That's the thing, is we come to these things, we're like, yeah, I know this, but we really, there's a lot we need to know, and I'm putting the onus on us to be accountable to that. So you should study who she is. She's a sister. She was in the Black Panther Party, and then she became involved in the Black Liberation Army. She was arrested, put in prison, put in an all-men's prison, put in Attica, put in the Clinton Correctional Facility back east, and some people busted her out of that prison in 1979, and she went to Cuba, and she's been in Cuba with political asylum since the mid-80s. And she's readily accessible in Cuba. You know, I went to Cuba, hung out with her 5-6 days. Cool sister, one of my heroines. You should know who she is.
I saw a whole piece on her on Democracy Now! That came out this week. But they didn't really clarify, like, they talked about her a lot, and talk about why the FBI was targeting her now, or what they're reasoning was for that.
She was basically blamed for killing a New Jersey state trooper, and so at the time it brought the entire New Jersey police force out and just hate, like burning effigies and just, and then so nowadays they're using that as a basis to say this person killed a police officer, they're high risk to security of America.
Right, but I'm saying though, I know that's what they're saying, but I don't think that's really what this thing is about with Assata Shakur. Assata Shakur's been in Cuba 26 years. Okay, she's a college professor there. It's really not about her posing a threat or anything like that. What's happening with Assata Shakur is about you all. They want to terrorize you, stop you from doing what you're doing in terms of your organizational work. That's really what that's about. She would be the first person to tell you that. It's really about terrorizing you and continuing this mentality that anybody that stands up against America is a terrorist and is a criminal, and whatever happens to them is okay. That's really what that's about right there. And so, you know, learn what you can about her, but what we do a lot of times is we want to focus on the individual, and this is about the masses of people. And we really got to understand that. Assata would be the, I'm telling you, she'd be the first one to tell you that. Mumia would be the first one to tell you that. It's not about them, the individual. We want to focus all this attention on these individuals, and it's like, keep doing the work. You want to honor them? Assata Shakur would be the first person to tell you that. You keep doing this work. Because she's still just as committed to her principles of revolution as she was in the 70s. Because they're going to always try to do this kind of stuff. Because, again, they're trying to justify. They're all about winning the hearts and minds. That's what all this is about. And they may not have the few of us in here, but they got your families. They got your friends. They got millions of people. That's what this is about. And we got to understand it, because we look at it from a context, well, I know that. Yeah, but you can't even talk to your sister or your brother about it. You can't even go to a dinner with them. You got to be quiet at the dinner table. Then who's really winning? You can convince yourself you know something, but once you die, that information's dead. We have to learn how to win hearts and minds. So that's why we got to look at this a little different than we're looking at it. So that's why I ask, what is the significance of the attacks against the post office to this subject? What do people think?
I think they're trying to privatize the post office. I mean, that started like, that was in the 70s, and when UPS and FedEx started,
right.
The private alternatives to the post office, and now they're trying to push even more into the private sector, so that we have to pay some corporation for what we now get as a public service.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say something very similar, kind of like where it's just like going back to privatizing the public resource. It's just like attack on working class poor and people of color, make it more difficult for them.
Right. I mean, both of you are right, but the last part you said, how is it attacked on people of color?
The post office source communication.
Right.
So we affect that, especially considering that with technology, it tends to be more for affluent populations. If you use the internet, things like that. I mean, it's readily available now, but definitely it's more for use of people who can't use those resources. So it would be an attack on the poor, essentially.
Yeah, that's true.
It also has a lot to do with who actually works in the post.
That's what I was trying to get to. That's a critical point. That's a critical point. You know, the post office, first, public agencies are the biggest employers of people of color in the society. It's not the private sector. We don't get hired in the private sector. So it's the public sector. And the post office has the highest percentage of people of color of any public agency. So that has a lot to do with this attack. Because if people can't work, they can't get jobs, what happens?
Crime.
Exactly. It gets into, again, back to this criminalization thing. That's what I'm trying to get to. And so that's why we see it like that. It's really a part of this whole thing. So how do they do this, like this incarceration thing? Because you hear all, you know, everybody talks about mass incarceration is a big topic now, and that's wonderful. But how does it work? How does it look? How does it function? What are the processes of it? Do you all know, like, Oregon and California, for example, have programs. They have joint venture programs. You all know about that? They have joint venture programs with corporations. And that's how it works. And what happens is that with these joint venture programs, the state gives huge tax breaks and subsidies to corporations to set up factories on prison grounds. And so they do that. So all of these corporations, like in California, for example, the California Department of Corrections, from 1994 through present day, has had contracts with companies like TWA, Chevron, Walmart. All these kind of companies have participated. So if any of you took a flight from TWA in the 90s, in the mid-90s, or you knew anybody, and they called to make reservations, chances are they probably were talking to someone at one of the state prisons in California, one of the people incarcerated there, who they employed to do that. And they did that from 1994 until 2000, until the public outrage was such, so they stopped. But Chevron had people developing components to work for their research there from the prison. And Walmart, like if you buy the clothes, like everybody talks about the clothes at Walmart aren't any good, right? You wear them once and they're gone, you know, they start tearing up. Well, those clothes are sold by California State Penitentiary inmates. And not only that, but the state of Oregon and the state of California, all their state agencies have contracts with the bureaus of prisons. So that all the, probably this furniture here, because this is a state institution, all the state institutions, the furniture is built by people in the prisons. And they have select contracts with the prisons so that these contracts by law, you know, it tells you how good their laws are. They're supposed to be bidded for. Yeah, like you want to bid for it, you get it if you have the best bid. They don't even do that. It's just sole source vending to the prison system because it's profitable to the state. So creates a condition where it's so advantageous to the state of Oregon, the state of California, and all these other states to have this constant pipeline of people going into the prisons because they supply this labor and it allows these states to, the state, not just the corporations, but it allows the states to generate revenue from people being in prison. And I just want to say that because I don't, you know, everybody knows about the corporate part of it, the privatization part, but the public sector is profiting from people being in prison as well through these contracted relationships. So now you got a scenario where you got to have a constant flow of people coming to prison to provide this labor and this profitability. And so the question is, you know, of course, who's going to go to prison? And it's these people that are criminalized and they're doing that. Now, the Obama administration just announced that they're going to allocate $5.5 billion to be funneled into ICE prosecutions over an indefinite year. That's a lot. Do you know that's more money than, like, countries' general gross national product for a lot of countries, that they're going to focus towards doing that. And then Dell Computer, who had ties to, they had a relationship with a recycling company called Unicor in 2003, they had these two cats at Cochran State Prison in California. They had them recycling these computers in an environment that was unsafe chemically. The guys got sick. One of the guys almost died. They had them working 20 hours a day, you know, doing this. And these guys filed a lawsuit and they won. These two guys that were incarcerated in Cochran. So this is why this happens, because it's very profitable. And this is also why you have three strikes, because you know 44% of the people convicted for the third strike are African in America. African folks convicted for, like, you heard about the guy stole a slice of pizza, walked out the pizza place, third strike, went to prison, for 10 years for the pizza, you know? So that's why that is. Gotta get people coming back in these institutions. The gang loitering laws, you know, Portland just passed one. Y'all know about that? That's like, if me and this brother, and Brother Jonas back there, three of us, if we're together on the street here talking, we could technically be arrested and charged with being a gang in Portland.
Gang activity.
Gang activity. That's what these laws are about. Gotta find a way to get people in prison in any way you possibly can. So the other part of this, which you all know, is equating political activism with crime and terrorism, which gets back to the Assata Shakur thing. So now they're trying to prosecute people, like standing up, like even just like, and I'm almost finished, and then I'm gonna open it up because we're gonna go. But I just want to say this: we're just really getting like, look at the case of what Inslee's facing right now. Now this is a case where people are in their, Darren and Patricia are in their house. That's their house, right? They're still in their house. This was October 30th. This happened. This is May 11th. They're still in their house. That's their house. They got an injunction. They're in the house. They just got the water turned back. We won the battle with the water bureau. They just got the water turned back on this week. So that's their house, clearly. They invited. People were there, right? I talked to them. They, oh, yeah, come on by, you know? So October 30th, people are there. The police are there. 30, 40 police with riot guns, shotguns. Nobody invited them. So who is trespassing? They're trying to say people were trespassing and you assaulted. If someone comes to your house uninvited with guns, you have a right to remove them from your house. But this is what they're doing mentally. Oh, you're assaulting police officers. You're a terrorist that's come to my house uninvited with guns. I have a right to... Some of them should have been shot for being there as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry. I mean, you have no right to be there, and you're challenging these people in their house. They have a right to defend themselves and do whatever they need to do. But this is what they're doing. So now, he's got to go on trial, probably, when really the real criminal should be on trial. But this is the mentality that's happening there. So we got to see this that's going on in that context. So they're criminalizing activism, particularly militant activism. So we got to ask the question, well, what do we do about that? How do we stop that from happening? Well, real quick, I think the key thing is, especially for Portland, we got to understand, if we're going to combat this criminalization ideology that's happening, we got to understand the difference between activism and organizing. And I don't think we understand that here. Like, I was at a meeting. We helped, you know, with May Day. So we had meetings. And so the theme for May Day here was joining an organization, working for justice, right? So we go around the room at the meetings, and we'd ask people, introduce yourself and your organization. If you don't have one, that's fine. But, you know, that's what we're talking about. So we go around, and people, well, I'm with this organization. And there's some people, I'm with Occupy. I'm like, well, what does that mean? I mean, what does that mean? Well, I'm with Occupy. Well, okay, that's cool. I'm not putting that down. But I'm saying the difference between activism and organizing. Like, a lot of us think, if I just go to events, if I go to marches, I'm an activist. Well, maybe you are. But I think we have to move more in this realm to when we're working with people, bringing people who are not in these rooms right now, politicizing them, politically educating them, and bringing them into the sphere of this movement. As many people as possible. There's a culture in here, in this town, that I oppose 100%. It's like this strong security thing, like, well, there's only going to be five or six of us. We're revolutionaries. No, you're not revolutionary. You're fantasizing. Revolution is masses of people. I'm sorry, you guys, if you believe that. I'm not about that at all. I'm like, we got to get as many people as possible. So the people that understand that, like, well, Eduardo, what do we do? I said, Eduardo, you got to get, Eduardo wants trying to organize a group of indigenous youth. So we're like, how do you do that? And I know he might have got frustrated with me, but I'm like, we're going to go over to this restaurant. I'm going to sit here. We're going to look at, you're going to organize an event on this campus. We're going to look at all the so-called Chicano studies departments. We're going to talk to those. You're going to go talk in those classes. You're going to talk to your people who ain't coming to no events like this and convince them to come out. And he did that. And now starting to bear fruit. All these people you've met, how many people you've met in the last week? Young indigenous youth. Right. That aren't coming to Law and Disorder right now. They ain't coming. They ain't going to be here this weekend. But you went to them and you got them. We got to do more of that. That's what I'm advocating. We got to do more. That's organizing. That's what that is. That's organizing. Now, some of you in here, you might have a problem with Minister Louis Farrakhan in the Nation of Islam. But I'm telling you this. If you want to see an example of an organizer, you look at Farrakhan. Farrakhan started in 1977 when Elijah Muhammad died and the Nation of Islam broke apart. It was just Farrakhan and two other brothers, Brother Akbar Muhammad, who was in Ghana. I used to go to his house a lot when I was in Ghana. And late brother Khalid Abdul Muhammad. It was just the three of them. And now, look, now they got thousands of people. They got mosques all over the country. That's because Farrakhan is, whatever you think about him, hey, I look at the devil. If the devil can show me how to organize for revolution, I will. So I respect Farrakhan's organizing ability. I look at that to learn how to do that. We got to get to more of that. That's what he's done. He didn't recruit just the same people into the, he recruited a whole new group of people. And they're still, Elijah Muhammad's been dead on 30 years, and they're still recruiting people. That's organization. That's what that is. That's what we got to get to. So that's what we're talking about. And then what should our relationship be to, you know, these movements, like things we don't agree with or things we don't understand? We have to expand that so that we can begin to work with people who come from a totally different perspective than us. Like, I'm a Pan-Africanist. I'm a revolutionary Pan-Africanist. But here in Portland, I work with LGBTQ, feminists, whoever is about, and respect where all those groups are coming from and support them genuinely, not on a fake level, but supporting what they're doing, because understanding that as they get stronger, that helps what I'm doing get stronger. And we got to do that. I hear a lot of, well, I don't deal with that because it, like some, I guess he was well-meaning, white guy. Well, I don't know about black nationalists. It's like, it's not for you to know. We're not asking your permission, you know? It's not for you to know. I mean, you got to understand, you got to realize if you're really serious about doing this or not. So we got to get past that and build effective coalitions. And the way you do that, what is an effective coalition? What constitutes a coalition to people in here?
A coalition that gets its goals achieved.
Right. But I'm saying, what basis do you go to people and say, we're going to work, we should work together in a coalition?
Recognition of mutual interests.
Right. Exactly. So we say that, but people still miss it. Because I worked with, for the party, I worked with the Million Man March when it was organized years ago. I can't believe it was 18 years ago. But when it was organized 18 years ago. So, you know, we want to revolutionize it. So we're in the meetings. And a guy comes in there and he says, well, we need to register people for the Democratic Party. And I'm like, well, that's not no coalition, because I ain't registering nobody for the Democratic Party. I can't even talk to you if that's your objective. So you can't have an agenda. You gotta, like Jonathan said, if you're gonna build a coalition, it's gotta be something where you say, this is something we all can agree on, and we organize from there, period. You gotta leave your agenda at the door and do it based on that. So that's where I wanted to stop, and then we're going to have time for discussion. I wanted to give Kenny a chance to say something, because, you know, I think he manifests what we're talking about here, this criminalization of people who rose up to stand up. As a former Black Panther and a former person who spent considerable time incarcerated, I wanted him to speak to that.
First of all, I think it's really important to understand what does it mean to be a political prisoner. Because I think that people think that if you're in prison, that you're a criminal. And due to what the brother was talking about, the conditions that exist in the black and the brown and peoples of color's communities, how we are marginalized, not a part of the system, that we are thus political people. We didn't necessarily choose that role. It was a role that was placed upon us because of who we are and what we look like. So it's important to know that I went to prison as someone that committed some crimes, but that doesn't diminish the fact that where I live, which was in South Central Los Angeles, the amount of opportunities for people who live in that community are virtually nil and none. And that their future is not in UCLA or UCLA, but it's in San Quentin or Folsom. That's the realities that exist. And I became a member of the party while I was in prison, recruited by one of the original Black Panthers who was also in prison. But what's important, and this is the key thing that I want to focus on, two central things. One is a man called George Jackson, who we give credence to not as an individual, but as someone who helped to create the prison movement. And in the 70s and the late 60s, the prison movement was a very viable movement that was actually from inside the institutions, shaking people up outside to become involved in political activity. Think about that. In the 60s and the 70s, people who were inside of prison, the prisons had become institutions for revolution because there were so many brothers and sisters who were going to the penitentiary, right? They were able to reach outside of the gates of the prison wall and infect people like you and me and other people to become involved in something. And the other point I want to make is that I got out of prison in 1975. Think about how many years ago that was. When I got out of prison in California, there were 13 prisons in California. Think about that. In 1975, there were 13 prisons in California. Today, in 2013, there's damn near 40 prisons in the state of California. Two very important factors happened in that time. In 1975, we're almost at the apex of the revolutionary movement that's taking place all across America. And people who are participating from his party, from SNCC, from the Black Panthers to the Black Muslims, the Black Liberation Army, it just goes on and on and on. These were the people who were populating the penitentiary. In 1983 and 1984, one very significant thing happened all across America, but particularly in Black neighborhoods, was the introduction of crack. And we went from 13 prisons in 1975 to damn near 40 today. And who do you think that the majority of the people are populating those prisons to do this work that he's talking about? Because the Fortune 500 companies in America, almost every single one of them have some presence in every prison in the state, in every state in this country. Every single one, from Revlon to Chevron, okay? So for those of you that use those products, you need to be conscious of the fact that that's slave labor at work. And that's the basic thing I want to say, because I think it's more important to have some conversation. Thank you.
That was Kenny, and before which we heard Ajamu Umi speaking on radical organizing at the Law and Disorder Conference at Portland State University earlier this month. Coming up, we will round out the hour with a segment from Between the Lines, courtesy of AM News Director Kathleen Stevenson, putting this together, editing it down for us. Thank you so much, Kathleen. Stay tuned to KBOO Portland.
Concern and questions surrounding the Obama administration's drone program targeting terrorist suspects abroad and a widespread hunger strike by detainees at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The president addressed the nation in a speech at the Defense University in Washington, D.C. on May 23rd. While justifying the conduct of the U.S. war against terrorism under his watch, Mr. Obama called for the eventual repeal of the post-9/11-2001 authorization for the use of military force that he said promotes a perpetual wartime footing and may give presidents too much power. The president admitted and then defended the U.S. drone strikes that have killed four American citizens as he proposed tighter restrictions on the future use of drones to reduce civilian casualties. Mr. Obama also outlined his plans to make good on his unfulfilled 2008 campaign pledge to close the Guantanamo Bay prison by lifting his own moratorium of transferring detainees to Yemen and appointing a new senior envoy to negotiate the release of additional prisoners to other nations. At several points in the speech, peace activist Medea Benjamin of the group Code Pink interrupted the president to condemn the government's drone program, to which Mr. Obama responded by saying, although he disagreed with her, that woman is worth paying attention to. Congressional Republicans were predictably critical of the president's revamping of counterterrorism policy. Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican of Georgia, declared, "The president's speech will be viewed by terrorists as a victory." Your reporter spoke with Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran and board member of the group Veterans for Peace, who takes a critical look at President Obama's recent speech reframing U.S. counterterrorism strategy.
The president's speech was both disappointing and sort of impressive. He spoke at times with candor. And so there are, you know, there is a group of people for which no matter what the president says on these policies, it'll never be good enough. And when I listen, and that's both Republican and Democrat, Libertarian, you know, the whole lot. And when I listen to the president speak, I heard a lot of things that he said that, to me, to my mind, weren't accurate. The first I take on is to say that the president essentially said he had this premise that using drones and these counterterrorism policies would somehow prevent future civilian casualties. And I think that is counterfactual, meaning that you can't prove it because it relies on things that haven't happened yet to prove that it's true. So now, to be fair, what I say about why the U.S. shouldn't use drones is the fact that we will radicalize people, and not just drones, but war in general will radicalize people, push people further to the fringes of their own culture and societies, and create and foment this anti-American sentiment. Now, what I have that President Obama doesn't have is a Yemeni activist and many, many others, but most notably a Yemeni activist who recently testified to Congress, to the Senate Judiciary Committee, that the drone strikes in his village had done more to radicalize people in Yemen than Al-Qaeda propaganda ever had. This was Faria al-Muslimi, who's, again, a Yemeni journalist and activist. So that's one thing. I think, you know, the president's counterterrorism policy based on this premise that we, by engaging in these military maneuvers, we are somehow preventing future conflict or greater civilian casualties, I think it's just false, and it's a highly flawed assumption. The other thing I'd say, the president said that Congress exercises oversight and that Congress is briefed on every drone strike. Well, that's not completely true. The DOD does voluntarily brief, and the CIA does voluntarily brief certain members of Congress on certain committees, most notably the House and Senate Armed Service and the House and Senate Intelligence or the Joint Select Intelligence Committee. But the vast majority of Congress, you know, right there you're talking about maybe 100 members or so altogether. The vast majority of Congress, House and Senate, does not receive briefings on these drone strikes. And by the way, when the people who are briefed get their briefings, they're sworn to secrecy because it's all top secret. So it's not like they can go and sit in a room somewhere and talk about this with other members. This is really a very small group of people who know about these things. So that, again, is highly problematic and is not an indicative of true oversight. You know, and the last thing I would say is that the president dropped a lot of important language from this aspect of his counterterrorism speech that he had before. In the past, the administration has said they only use lethal force on key Al-Qaeda leaders. And McClatchy News actually did a really good debrief of this. The president dropped that key leadership of Al-Qaeda language completely and only named associated forces. Now, the authorization of the use of military force, or AMF, which was passed in 2001, authorizes the president to take action against nations harboring or affiliates, people who conducted the terrorist attacks in 9/11. over the last 4, 5, 6 years or so, we've seen this policy morph into Al-Qaeda not only in Afghanistan, but Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, groups that aren't associated with Al-Qaeda like Al-Shabaab in Somalia and a handful of other places. And these groups are typically known as associated forces, which is to say, as far as we know, there are no clear links to Al-Qaeda, the actual organization, but ideological affiliation. And effectively, what this comes down to, this associated forces language, comes down to the fact that the president has used the AUMF, the 2001 law, to justify military action all over the world in just about any place that they deem fit, as long as there's an associated force and an imminent threat. And imminent means that essentially the administration doesn't need evidence, and imminent can be any period of time. Senator Angus King from Maine, in the Armed Service Committee hearing a week ago on the AUMF, really took down administration witnesses on that. He said that you've essentially made up the language associated forces. So all of this was contained in this very long, very complex speech. And what it really comes down to is that these laws, three, and just three of many, are very substantial and I think need to be addressed not by just by Congress, but also by the administration.
Matt, the president also talked about closing the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Detention Center in Cuba. Do you think this is just rhetoric, or do you think this time the president and his administration will move substantively to close that facility?
You know, I think the administration actually made moves early on to start transferring detainees out of Guantanamo. They moved a number of prisoners out. Really, since the start of the Obama administration, there were 242 prisoners in Guantanamo. Right now, there are about 166. So the president has made moves. I think Congress made that much more difficult. The Republican Party in the House, particularly on the Armed Service Committee, made it incredibly difficult for the president to transfer current detainees to Yemen and other countries or to the United States. The president does have the authority to take more action than he has. You know, I don't sit inside the office, but I'm not sure if it's because of political reasons or for some other reason. The president has been slow on this, but I think the president could definitely move a little faster. From my point of view, it is morally reprehensible that some of these people who have been essentially acquitted are still locked up in prison to the point that they are so hopeless, they're engaged in a hunger strike, literally putting their lives on the line because it's all they have left. I've read the bios and some of these articles, and it's really just heart-wrenching. I was pleased to see the president using his executive powers to lift some of the transfer memoranda on detainees toward Yemen. I think those are all positive steps in the right direction. I think history will look back on Guantanamo Bay as a really dark part of the U.S. history in this global armchair. There are a lot of dark places, but that's going to be a particularly dark one.
That was Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran, board member of the group Veterans for Peace, and legislative associate with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Find links to Southworth's recent articles on U.S. wars abroad by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of the Creative Music Guild's second annual Improvisation Summit, Friday, May 31st and Saturday, June 1st at Sandbox Studio. 2 days of exciting performances featuring local artists and William Hooker from New York City. Performers include Golden Retriever, Daniel Menchi, Battle Hymns and Gardens, 1939 Ensemble, and more. Also, there will be workshops, panel discussions, dance, as well as film performances presented by Cinema Project and Experimental Film Festival. The Creative Music Guild is a locally based nonprofit dedicated to presenting adventurous music from the worlds of jazz and experimental avant-garde since 1991. For more information, go to creativemusicguild.org or ask at the information table when you attend the Improvisation Summit on May 31st and June 1st at the Sandbox Studio located at 420 Northeast 9th Avenue in Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 9:59 a.m. This just in, on Monday, June 3rd, citizens in Vancouver, Washington are coming together to pass a resolution at the City Council to end corporate personhood. To learn more and be a part of this process, come to a meeting this Monday, June 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at the Vancouver Community Library, which is located at 901 C Street in Vancouver in the Skamania Room. One more time, an event, a meeting, Monday, June 3rd, 6:30 p.m. at the Vancouver Community Library, 901 C Street in Vancouver in the Skamania Room, to plan an action to pass a resolution at the City Council to end corporate personhood. This is KBOO Portland, your electronic community resource. Check it out, won't you? Coming up at 10, we'll hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an in-depth interview with Middle East scholar Phyllis Bennis on the expanding war in Syria. At 11, it's Portland Prepared, with a focus on the psychology of disasters. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned, won't you?
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, May 31st, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Well, Bradley Manning's court-martial begins bright and early Monday, or maybe not. We'll find out. There are rumblings of dismissal in the air. And as we mentioned yesterday, the Nature Conservancy sells out, or perhaps is bought out by Wall Street across the country and as far away as Japan. And in all probability, there will be a little blowback from Europe. Don't even think about the results that will have on the markets. But Monsanto's cover crop is indeed being blown by revelations from a field in Oregon. This is a story that is probably going to be around for a while because it does shine a bright light on reasons that other nations have for rejecting genetically modified organisms. And much more along those lines. First, this from the National Weather Service. Let me point out that in the middle of the country, our rapidly growing dust bowl is seeing more severe weather, and still not a whisper that it might be related to climate collapse. Partly sunny skies today for us here in Cascadia. Highs near 68 tomorrow, overcast, tonight, overcast, lows around 50. For tomorrow, look for partly sunny skies with a high near 74. And for Saturday night, lows around 52. Sunday, could still get some more showers. Highs near 68, not much in the way of wind. Sunday night, partly cloudy, lows around 50, bringing us full circle to Monday morning. We're going to leave it off for the alternative forecast. If anyone would like to hear it, I'll put that up on the KBOO website, because right now I'm very pleased to welcome our first guest of the day, Ray McGovern. Good morning, Ray, and thank you so much for taking the time today to speak with us.
You're most welcome.
Well, this, of course, is front and center on many people's minds today. It's Friday. There are going to be actions across the country and indeed across the world on behalf of Bradley Manning. There was in past months even a march in Kabul, Afghanistan. You, of course, would be the first person we want to think of, one of the first people anyway, when we talk about whistleblowers and the role that they play in current day American society, and why that role is becoming riskier and riskier. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that this particular administration has got so much to hide? And of course, we've just seen the fiasco with the Associated Press reporters. Can you give us, at least from your perspective, why you think the draconian measures?